It's got a death curse.
So it's bothering me like me.
And then who locked you up in the sewer?
Just like having a wart removed.
What's the boogeyman?
As a matter of fact, it was.
My friends, welcome back to the Horror 101 show. On this very special 44th episode, the world-famous Brian Stewart, the cult sensation Nick McPherson, and myself are going to pay tribute to the late, great Sir Christopher Lee.
The hour grows late, and Gandalf the Grey rides to Isengard, seeking my counsel.
This is Fu Manchu. In a few days' time, I shall speak again to this country, and through it to the entire world.
My name is Scaramanga, Francisco Scaramanga. I feel I know you, although I never thought we should ever really meet.
Mr. Harker, I'm glad that you've arrived safely.
Count Dracula.
I am Dracula, and I welcome you to my house.
So, gentlemen, we are here on a sad note today. We made the Babadook show, and as you heard, at the beginning we were talking about Betsy Palmer, who had passed away. And then we were talking about all the horror icons that were getting pretty long in the tooth, and I suggested that Christopher Lee might be the next one to go. And sure enough, while I was editing the show, the guy passes away.
This death will have ripple effects. You know, it'll be felt, at least by those of us who know anything about film, right? I'm not so sure newer fans are going to know how important he is.
These are the people that, during the whole heyday, the rise of it, the competition, like, you know, oh, British cinema. There is no British cinema now.
Yeah.
He was there for its rise and its fall, to the point where people of our generation don't even realize it existed.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like a historical figure. Like him, at least, he managed. Like, think about all the other actors of his generation that just were, again, discarded into obscurity.
Yeah, gone for decades.
Yeah. He's like the last torchbearer.
It's almost uncanny to think that he's gone. He seemed like an eternal, you know, figure. That now that he's no longer there, it's just like, you're taken aback.
Christopher Frank Carandini Lee was born May 27th, 1922. The man has been in over 250 film and TV appearances, holds the world record for the most sword fights as an actor on screen. But before this distinguished acting career, Mr. Lee had proved to be a venerable soldier in World War II. And being related to Bond film creator Ian Fleming, it was rumored that his experiences behind enemy lines was the footprint used to create 007.
It goes back a long way. It goes back to the Second World War. I was in what they call Special Forces. I was in the Air Force and also attached to Special Forces. So I have a lot of connections, even now, with the Special Forces from all over the world. And I always carry on me the identification, there it is.
The membership cards?
Of the SAS.
CFFC Lee.
That's right.
In warfare, he reported to Winston Churchill for a division that was colorfully referred to as the
Department of Ungentlemanly Warfare.
Ungentlemanly Warfare, which basically mean that he knew how to fucking kill people.
And he kept his secrets to himself all the way up to his death. You know, whether or not he told his wife anything, because he was married for a long, long time.
Well, yeah, that's all like classified. Yeah,
he took classified right to the grave.
Oh, you had to.
Shortly after the war, he decided to take a crack at acting. But a lot of the British cinema powers that be didn't like the stuff he was made of.
I have quite definitely proved a great many people wrong. The people who said, you're too tall to be an actor. You're too foreign looking to be an actor.
Apparently Lee had a hard time getting a lot of work only because he was so tall. The guy was 6'5".
But that's what made such a great villain in horror. Vincent Price and Christopher Lee, they were tall, slender, long-faced guys with really good voices.
Yeah.
And they had sinister voices that worked really well. And so they were almost like mustache-twirling perfection when it came to horror villains in that time frame.
Well, it's like that one Jaguar commercial. Have you ever noticed how all the best villains are British?
Yeah, that's well, look at the Evil Empire in Star Wars, right? They're all British
actors.
Yeah,
they're all British. Yeah. Yeah. They're all British white guys. But, yeah, I mean, Christopher Lee, always a great villain. I mean, you think of Christopher Lee, he's usually playing a villain. I mean, between 57, 58, and 59, the guy played all the great Universal horror villains from the 30s.
Yeah.
And like in 50s, and they were all Hammer horror movies. Hammer was starting out with their horrors in the late 50s. They casted a very not well-known Christopher Lee to play Frankenstein, the monster Frankenstein, who we play with Peter Cushing in 57.
Perhaps you had better start from the beginning. Perhaps you had better start from the beginning. Perhaps you had better start from the beginning. Perhaps you had better start from the beginning.
Did you ever wonder where that came from?
Where did it all begin? I suppose it was when I was a boy at school. I always had a brilliant intellect.
You know, it's interesting. You look at the kind of movies that Hammer was famous for, the commercially popular ones, and these were the pop stories of their day. This was Pulp Fiction of its day, right? So you look at the comics, like the common popular stories like Dracula, Wolfman, Frankenstein. These were all the big name genre pieces of literature, right? And it almost shows now what Hollywood is thinking in the modern age, using comic books as their reference. Because these were the comic book movies of their day, before comic books invented.
Well, before they got into superheroes, it was mostly horror comics.
Right.
Before they got rid of them with The Code and all that crap.
But all your heroes were from, like, the boys' adventure novels of H. Rider Haggard, or you looked at the event. All the great adventure stories that Hollywood would have told would have been either, like, Tarzan or, like, horror, right?
The Curse of Frankenstein was Hammer's first color horror film starring Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee. They shot it in 5 weeks and it cost £65,000 to make. It generated over $7 million worldwide. It was a success that would allow Hammer to continue making world scene pictures for decades to come, and it instantly made stars of Cushing and Lee. The next year, Hammer would pit them against each other again in their version of Stoker's Dracula.
Mr. Harker, I'm glad that you've arrived safely.
Count Dracula.
I am Dracula, and I welcome you to my house.
I mean, you think Christopher Lee, and you immediately think Dracula. Before anything else, before James Bond, before Count Dooku, before anything else he's done, only because he played Dracula 8 times for Hammer.
Yeah.
You know, and they got progressively, arguably, you could say they got worse. You and I watched the horror Dracula. That was the first time you'd seen it. What did you think of that one? That was 1958.
That was a lot of fun, actually. And, of course, you got legend Peter Cushing in there as well.
Count Dracula, the propagator of this unspeakable evil, has disappeared. He must be found and destroyed.
You can see why it would have been somewhat frightening for somebody of the day, because there was actual blood effects. Typically, blood wasn't shown, or it was... This is just after black and white was starting to transition to color in the 50s.
Yeah, and you had that brilliant red Technicolor gore on the screen.
To see red spilling down someone's body, I think, would have absolutely shocked people.
May I?
Yes, certainly.
Your wife?
No, my fiancée.
You're a very fortunate man, Mr. Harker. May I ask her name?
Lucy. Lucy Homewood.
Charming.
You're very kind.
Now, this, what you saw here of Dracula, suave, debonairish kind of deal, that's the last time you see Dracula like that in any capacity.
Right.
You know, like 5 minutes after that, he's the maniac with the freaking red eyes and the teeth
Yeah.
Complete despot, completely evil.
He's no longer Jerry Dandridge.
Exactly. Yeah.
Master, I did it. I summoned you. It was my will.
He was 100% evil, and that was always the point. There was always, you know, good versus evil, good trying to take care of the evil. And they kind of recycled themselves because they would kill him at the end, they'd do something that would destroy a vampire, and he would be destroyed, like, to dust or whatever. Right. And then they'd find a way to resurrect him for the next movie, only to destroy him again, only to resurrect him for the next movie, to just... He's been resurrected and completely destroyed 8 times, you know?
That's why we have Castlevania sequels. So.
Yeah.
Who has done this thing? Who has done this thing?
I see the parallels now that Fright Night really does borrow quite a bit from this. Because that's what Dandridge does, right? To get back at Charlie, he goes after Amanda Beers.
Right. And he does that in the third movie, where the Monsignor goes and does a blessing on the Castle Dracula, yeah. Puts the big cross on his door. He goes to Buddy's hometown and starts taking out, like, his daughter, his wife, his cousin, you know, one by one. Right. He's taking out his family as revenge for performing that rite on his castle.
It's a whole extra layer of depravity that he doesn't just want them to die, he wants them to suffer. He wants them to see everyone die before them, before they go.
Although Lee played Dracula 7 times for Hammer, it was only the first couple that he really wanted to do. The other ones, his arm was kind of twisted.
I turned down all but the first two. There was a gap of 7 or 8 years between the first and the second, which I didn't speak at all. Then I made whatever it was, 4 more, I think, 3 or 4 more, I can't remember, over the years. Every single one of those stories I turned down and said, no, I will not do it. I don't like the story. It's nothing to do with the character, and I don't want to play the part anymore. I can't do anything more with it. What happened? Every single time that no got back to Hammer was I got hysterical telephone calls. You've got to do it, you've got to do it, you've got to do it. And I said, I don't have to do it and I don't want to do it. And I'm not going to do it, but you've got to do it, you have to do it. You must do it. And I said, why? Think of the people you'll put out of work if you don't do it. So what do I do? Am I going to be held responsible for putting 90 to 100 people out of work? Actors? Actresses, directors, writers, producers, technicians. How could I? So I did them. And that is the only reason why. It certainly wasn't for money.
Lee played the Mummy, Frankenstein's monster, Jekyll and Hyde characters. He was the star of all of their greatest horror successes. But in that time, he proved to be an asset for other films as well. One of the greatest examples was when he played the mad monk Rasputin.
During the time that I've been here, you tried to teach me the confession of my sins is good for the soul.
Well?
You also removed all temptation from among us so that there's no chance of any sin here. I've merely tried to put that right. When I go to confession, I don't offer God small sins, petty squabbles, jealousies. I offer him sins worth forgiving.
How dare you blaspheme?
He played Rasputin? That's now 3 people I know who played Rasputin.
I remember reading Rasputin's either granddaughter or great-granddaughter watched the movie, the Hammer film from, I think it was 66 or 67, and was like, she couldn't believe how close he actually was.
Really?
To the real man. Like his mannerisms and the way he talked and stuff like that. Apparently it was a really, really good performance, so let's check that out.
I only know I have this power. I have always had it. I can feel it burning within me, driving me on. It is here inside me. It is in my hands. And I warn you all, that I, Grigory Efimovich Rasputin, intend to use it. The power is mine, and I shall use it as I please.
That whole movie, he is a complete asshole. Like, just conniving, womanizing, drunkard, just, like, almost puts Dracula to shame because he's a real person, you know what I mean? And he infiltrates the czars, and he's a charlatan, you know? And he basically, okay, in the film, he uses suggestion or
hypnotism
yeah. to get in.
Apparently, the Tsar's son was really sick. I don't know if it's the same as in this movie.
It's the Tsarina's son.
Yeah, yeah. And in actual real life, it was believed that he used to use hypnosis to help him ease his pain, help him place his mind somewhere so that he wasn't preoccupied.
But in the end, as we all know, Rasputin was hard to kill.
Oh, he was.
They tried poisoning him. They gave him enough poison to kill like 3 elephants. He just wouldn't go down. They stabbed him. They shot him. He just wouldn't go down. He ended up drowning.
They beat him.
They beat him. Yeah.
Didn't they tear him apart after he was.
He was tossed in the river.
Mussolini.
Oh yeah.
Wasn't he thrown in the river too?
He was thrown in the river and he ended up drowning.
Yeah.
That's what finally killed him. So yeah, if you get a chance, watch Rasputin. What a great performance. He is just so connivingly evil
yeah.
in that film. Really good film.
Evil, like the fruits of the devil.
He's got the height again, which works so well for that character, because Rasputin in real life was a tall, imposing figure.
I didn't know where that was from. Okay, until I was making these clips and I chanced upon this one.
Though, as I've said, little is known today of the actual practice of witchcraft in 17th century New England. Superstition, fear, and jealousy drove the Puritans to accuse their friends and relatives of consorting with the devil.
So, like, artists like Rob Zombie was referencing this guy's work from the 60s, you know, in music that he made in the 2000s.
Well, there's also rumors that, to an extent, that James Bond was partially influenced by Christopher Lee, because if I'm not mistaken, Ian Fleming was his cousin.
Distant cousin.
And they were drinking buddies.
They were drinking buddies. And Ian Fleming was in the intelligence service during the war, too.
Yeah. The man with the golden gun.
And as we all know, Mr. Lee was a Bond villain in the 70s. He was the man with the golden gun.
That was the first time I'd ever seen Christopher Lee.
Really?
He was playing Scaramango. Francisco Scaramango. With a superflua papula, whatever.
Superfluous papula. Yeah. third nipple for yes, Adam Vaughn.
I was just going to say, if you didn't know what that was, you have a third nipple.
He had, like, the most bizarre of all of the Bond henchmen. Knick-knack, played by Hervé Villechaize.
Who was the little guy from Fantasy Island.
Yeah.
Deplane, boss.
You'll be the death of me yet, Knick-knack.
You see, Mr. Bond, like every great artist, I want to create an indisputable masterpiece once in my lifetime. The death of 007. Mano a mano. Face to face. A duel between titans. My golden gun against your Walther PPK. Each of us with a 50-50 chance.
6 bullets to your 1.
I only need 1.
You know, what I liked about Man with the Golden Gun is that it had a much different kind of plot and feel to it than other Bond movies. It wasn't so black and white, and it wasn't, you know, some mad genius plotting to overthrow the world. That he really was just a professional killer who had his own plans and his own... It wasn't about necessarily being evil. He was about promoting solar energy and promoting a better world. And it wasn't so, you know, cartoonishly diabolical as, say, Moonraker or, and so I kind of like that it was just two professionals who just happened to come at odds under the, you know... Rather odd, unusual circumstances, eh? So
it was made during the oil crisis, and that's why, like, he was getting a jump on solar energy, and then he was going to franchise it out and make billions. So he, like, that was his...
Which is not evil, that's just business.
That's capitalism. That's capitalism, yeah. That's it. And like you said, he didn't really have anything against Bond, although Bond thought, because somebody sent the letter to MI6 or MI5... that he was gunning for him.
Right.
He tried to find him first, and he just gets wrapped up in it from there. He was offered 2 roles that he declined, one of which went to his friend Peter Cushing, because they originally wanted him to be Grand Moff Tarkin. He turned it down. It went to Peter Cushing.
Okay.
That was interesting. But he was approached
by the people that made Halloween to play Dr. Loomis.
Really?
He declined, and it went to Sam Loomis. And if you look on the IMDb trivia, he credits that to one of his greatest mistakes, was turning down that role.
And yet, I can't see anyone else playing it after seeing Donald Pleasance in that role.
Yeah, I would agree. I would agree. Yeah, now that I look at the way it was written and, you know, the trench coat and stuff like that, I couldn't see Christopher Lee playing it. Yes. But
it would have given because he has a different charisma. It would have
given that, but he's so imposing that you wouldn't be as frightened for Christopher Lee.
He'd be taller than Michael Myers.
Pleasance has a kind of confidence in the role, but he doesn't seem indestructible. But Christopher Lee would be too huge.
But his build, you know, he's balding, he's kind of schlubby, you know, this is not the guy, like, he's the guy, you know, he's.
He seems more like a psychiatrist, too. He seems like a doctor, a healer. Christopher Lee would come across as more menacing than Michael Myers.
You have to rewrite the end and just see Christopher Lee just beating the fuck out of Michael
Christopher
Myers.
Christopher Lee, if he had agreed to play Michael Myers, that I would have seen. That would have been cool.
Prisoner before us, you have been tried and condemned of crimes almost without number. Your efforts to build an empire of crime have today brought you to the end you so richly deserve. Let all who envy your thirst for power take note of your fate. Executioner, in the name of Imperial China, death to Fu Manchu.
There was another series that I'm not very familiar with. I don't think I've seen any of them all the way through, but apparently were very popular because he made five of them. Christopher Lee played Fu Manchu for Hammer.
Okay.
Five times, starting in 65. I'm not too sure, but watching the clips from Fu Manchu, I recognize that Lo Pan from Big Trouble in Little China, him and his Wing Kong, I guarantee you were modeled after this this villain. Because I was going through the movies, and sure enough, his henchmen, they had the black suits with the red bandanas. And all the red, they look like they came right out of Big Trouble from Little China. I'm like, he definitely got that from the Fu Manchu series.
As you were the leader of the rebellion, you shall be the first to go to the snakes. Release that girl at once!
Commissioner Nayland Smith, foolhardy as ever.
Release that girl.
She will not be released, and neither will you. But your presence will add to our celebrations.
You have nothing to celebrate, Fu Manchu. You will release that girl now and order your men to line up over there.
Send her to the snakes.
And they shot a lot of it in Asia. I remember watching an interview with Lee, where he was on a boat and he was on his way to the set, and they had him in the getup, the right. Fu Manchu getup with, you know, the slanty eyes, the Asian makeup, right? And this Asian asked him, he's like, well, who are you supposed to be? And he's like, oh, I'm playing a part, but I feel kind of silly because I'm British. And the guy's like, well, what's your name? And he's like, Lee, Christopher Lee. He's like, there, Lee, that's an Asian name. You fit the part, no problem.
Which brings me to the second course. There is a town upstate, 2 days' journey to the north in the Hudson Highlands. It is a place called Sleepy Hollow. Have you heard of it?
You know, his performance in that almost reminded me of Alec Baldwin's in Glengarry Glen Ross, in that it was a short, brief appearance that set the tone for the rest of those movies.
Well, especially with Christopher Lee, too, especially if you look at, like, his older stuff, and then once, you know, Tim Burton started pulling him in for a couple things and that, like him, right. Vincent Price, and then him, you know, by this point, he's obviously aged by this point, like, right. You know, in his 60s at the very least, maybe 70s, but he carries, like, you know, still the delivery, like, it's almost like his voice has taken on a slightly deeper timbre. Like, he's just got, like, this little extra... He's got this extra gravitas that age comes with it. Like, he just carries on, like, this patriarchal tone.
And not only that, but what a way to lend seriousness and tone to his movie. To establish this film as not your typical Tim Burton movie, as something dark and more classic in tone.
Three persons have been murdered there all within a fortnight. Each one found with the head lopped off.
Lopped off?
Clean as dandelion heads, apparently. You will take these experimentations of yours to Sleepy Hollow, and there you will detect the murderer. Bring him here to face our good justice. Will you do this?
You know, like, his voice, the, you know, the judgment of saying, this is your test, you know, resonates for the rest of that film. That this is, you know, his to do or die moment. And not only that, but the fate of justice rides with him, right? Because if he fails, things are going to go about in the old, torturous, you know, ignorant manner, right? So there's a lot riding on it, and who's better, you know, who better to portray that judgment, that trial, than to have that resonating voice of Christopher Lee?
Remember, it is you, Ichabod Crane, who is now put to the test.
Let's talk about Dooku, okay? Even though episode one, two, and three fucking suck, George Lucas can blow me. Right. I love the original Star Wars just like anybody else.
The undoctored version of the original.
Even him as Dooku couldn't save it, you know? Like, I enjoyed watching him as Dooku. His performance wasn't enough to just take me out of the suck of episodes two and three. I'm sorry, it just...
Master Yoda.
Count Dooku.
You have interfered with our affairs for the last time.
Battle between him and Yoda was one of the most unintentionally hilarious scenes in film. The entire franchise was such an embarrassment. I think he agreed to do it because he passed on the Grand Moff Tarkin role, right?
More than likely.
And he felt regrets, and he still wanted to be part of that franchise, and this was his last chance. At this point in his life, he's got to be thinking to himself, I don't have many opportunities like this left to really contribute and give back to fans, right?
But even then, like, from a narrative point of view, it's like, okay, I'm a Sith now. Okay, why?
And he achieved Sith level 90, so he could use lightning.
Yeah, right? Exactly, like, he could do the lightning thing.
That should have just been the Emperor's thing.
Like, you know? He gets bonus points for cutting off, you know, Hayden Christensen's hand, but...
I mean, this was like 2002 and 2005, okay? Yeah. Christopher Lee was already pushing 80 at the time.
Yeah.
So you're not going to expect him to be swinging around doing sword fights at 80. We can understand that.
Right.
But in hindsight, Christopher Lee, I mean, he was in the Three Musketeers in the 70s. He's done tons of swordplay.
He was a soldier.
And he, apparently, there's a lot of films where he was actually doing his own swordplay. I think it was Errol Flynn that actually cut his hand in a film that he did in like 1947.
Right.
Apparently Errol Flynn was hammered and they're shooting the sword scene and he fucking cut his hand.
It is obvious that this contest cannot be decided by our knowledge of the Force, but by our skills with a lightsaber.
Hammer recently started making horror movies again. The studio, after
Woman in Black,
decades, and, yeah, started making movies again.
Freaking Harry Potter, of all people.
One of the first ones that they made was called The Resident with Hilary Swank.
Yeah.
And they asked Christopher Lee, like, listen, it's a Hammer, it's a horror, would you mind being in it? And he's like, yeah, I'll be in it. So they gave him the role of the grandfather of this, of one of the main characters in it, which I thought was really cool.
I know everything that goes on in this building. I know everything that goes on in your head. You think I don't know how your brain works? Just like your father. Jealous and perverted. That's enough. Your mother, she was beautiful. She married a weak man. Then she gave birth to another.
But yeah, Christopher Lee plays the grandfather of that guy. And
Morgan. Dean Morgan is something Dean Morgan.
Yeah, there's three names.
Yeah.
It was great to see him in another Hammer horror after so many years. Jeffrey Dean Morgan, thank you. And that film right there, you know, you think you know what's going on, and then it just hits you in the gut. And I would hazard anybody who's has a problem with any kind of sexual assault not watch that movie.
For the younger generation, there's no doubt that Christopher Lee will be best remembered as the evil wizard Saruman from Peter Jackson's version of Tolkien's Lord of the Rings.
With Christopher Lee, and this is a good example, you get a sense of somebody who has spent their entire life mastering the art of oratory. Mm-hmm. Like, great voice and great actors know how to use their voice to full range. That voice, at its best, has timbre, has volume, resonance, has tone, and it rises and falls, and it knows how to, almost like musical notes, right? That it's not just words being spoken, that you can, you know, put such inflection into what you're saying.
And the cadence, and when he raises his voice, not only does it change in pitch and volume, but it also just, like, it's like he becomes a different person when he...
It's almost like his dialogue is scored.
The hour is later than you think. Sauron's forces are already moving. The Nine have left Minas Morgul.
The Nine?
They crossed the River Isen on Midsummer's Eve, disguised as riders in black.
They've reached the Shire.
They will find the ring and kill the one who carries it.
Frodo.
That was cool as fuck. When you found out that Saruman the White had turned to the dark side, that was like, oh my god. Because he's supposed to be like this grand-ass wizard. He was the wizard that Gandalf sought for counsel.
Tolkien basically established there was a hierarchy. There was the White Wizard, the Grey Wizard,
the Brown,
and the Blues. There was the two Blues, but the Blues went east and nobody ever heard from them again. Yeah.
Sauron endured.
And has been banished.
He will flee into the east.
Gondor should be warned. They must set a watch on the walls of Mordor.
No. Look after the Lady Galadriel.
She has spent much of her power. Her strength is failing.
Take her to Lothlorien.
My lord Saruman, he must be hunted down and destroyed once and for all.
Without the Ring of Power, Sauron can never again hold dominion over Middle-earth. Go now. Leave Sauron to me.
That's the last thing that he made for the screen for us right there. Him reprising Saruman at the age of 90 fucking one or two.
Yeah.
You know, and
even more amazing is the fact that he was friends with Tolkien.
Yeah. When they did the first Lord of the Rings trilogy, they put his ass on a plane, a 16-hour flight, to fly him to New Zealand and do that. And when they asked him, okay, we'd like you to play Saruman again, he's like, here's the deal. If I can shoot it from London, I will do it for you. So they grabbed the green screen and the cameras, and all of his scenes were done in London, so he was not on set with Cate Blanchett or Hugo Weaving.
I mean, the fact that he used to pal around with
J.R.R. Tolkien,
and that would have been C.S. Lewis at the time, too, because they were both professors. I mean, that era, that time period at Oxford was the birth and the heart, really, of
modern
British
fantasy.
Legend. It was British
modern,
legend.
Modern fantasy, yeah.
Because, really, Tolkien wrote the, you know, the Hobbit story and Lord of the Rings because he felt that there was no real great British mythology. I mean, there was Malory talking about Arthur, but that was written by a Frenchman.
Well, not only that, it was based on stories handed down through, you know, the Roman colonization of Britannia.
Right.
Yeah.
But, I mean, Tolkien is, for the British, their piece of mythology, right? And to say that means that Christopher Lee, having been part of that era, is with his passing, is really kind of the death of legend. And to lose him, that's a huge chunk of, you know, the spy genre, of fantasy that is lost, you know, that what he takes with him is monumental.
Hello, and greetings to you all, wherever you may be.
And thank you, as always, for your appreciation and help during my life as an actor.
On June 7th of this year, Mr. Lee passed away in Chelsea, Westminster, London, at the age of 93. It goes without saying that he leaves behind a great legacy, and everyone here at Horror 101 will miss him dearly. Not just for his horror contributions, for which there were many, but also for his perseverance, him never retiring, and graciously entertaining us until the very end. For the world-famous Brian Stewart and cult sensation Nick McPherson, this is Cash Wampum bidding a fond farewell to Sir Christopher Lee.
I must apologize for not being here to greet you personally, but I trust that you have found everything you needed.